Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 16, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing net neutrality regulation and litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to welcome today two guests, two experts. Brett Shumate is a partner at Wiley Ryan and Fielding. I'm sorry, Wiley Ryan we call it now. Sorry for that. Showing my age a bit. And our second expert, Adam J. White. He's counsel at Boyd & Gray and Associates. We're going to have some back and forth between the two of them. We're going to begin with Mr. Shumate, who's going to give us an overview of some of the issues involved in the litigation. Then Mr. White's going to talk about the Constitution, some of the constitutional issues. Then back to Mr. Shumate on the First Amendment. But ultimately, we'll be coming to the audience for questions, probably close to the 30-minute mark or so. So do be thinking of those questions. But for now, Mr. Shumate, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Again, Brett Shumate at Wiley Ryan, and happy to be here today. As you said, Dean, I think it's helpful to kind of give an overview of where we are in the litigation, and then I'd like to talk just briefly about what are the key issues in the case that are likely to be decided in the court, and then Adam and I are going to talk a little bit more detail about the First Amendment and the constitutional statutory interpretation questions that are, I think, are really interesting. So in terms of where we are in the litigation, we're currently in the D.C. Circuit. Oral argument scheduled for December 4th. Briefing is now complete, and we're headed toward argument. In terms of who the parties are, I think an overview of who the petitioners and interveners are can be useful to your understanding of the case. There's probably about a dozen petitioners challenging the FCC's open internet order. I kind of put them in three buckets. The lead petitioners in the first bucket are the main trade associations of the telcos and the cable industry trade associations. So U.S. Telecom, CTIA, NCTA are kind of the lead petitioners in the case. The second bucket of petitioners are my clients, Alamo Broadband and Daniel Berninger, who are not only challenging Title II regulation of the internet, but also challenging the specific net neutrality rules that the FCC adopted in this order, specifically under the First Amendment and Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act. Then the third bucket of petitioners are a group of competitive telecommunications carriers, or CLECs, as we call them in the telco world. And they are actually challenging the order as not going far enough in regulating internet access service providers. So they are specifically challenging the FCC's forbearance decision. So in the order, the FCC not only classified broadband under Title II of the Telecommunications Act, but also granted forbearance from various regulations under Title II of the Act. So they're challenging that decision of the FCC. And on the other side, you've got the FCC, and they've got dozens of interveners supporting them, as well as amici. Adam is representing several interveners supporting the petitioners, and I'll let him introduce those folks. But in terms of a broad overview of what the issues in the case are now, I think we've identified, or at least narrowed the case down to six main issues, which is all a lot of issues for an appeal. But in this case, each one of them, I think, are very serious and weighty and are going to be difficult for the court to grapple with. The first main issue, kind of the big kahuna in the case, is whether the FCC was correct in classifying broadband internet access service under Title II of the Communications Act. The FCC had previously classified broadband as an information service. That decision was upheld by the Supreme Court in Brand X in 2005, and the FCC has now reversed that decision, and the question is whether that is a correct interpretation of the statute. And Adam will get into, I think, a really interesting Chevron deference issue that's at play there. But the FCC's argument is that the Supreme Court in Brand X decided that this is an ambiguous statute, and we permissively interpreted the statute in this case to now classify broadband as a telecommunication service. The carriers on the flip side are arguing that the statute is clear, and there's a dispute between the FCC and the main carriers about what the Supreme Court actually decided in Brand X. So I think that's going to be crucial issue to be decided in the case and one that everybody's going to be watching. The second issue is the classification of mobile broadband internet access service, which is, you know, a subset of telecommunications service, but, excuse me, of internet access service, but, you know, on your mobile devices and other mobile applications. And so the main carriers have argued that mobile broadband is doubly immune from common carriage regulation under the statute, and the FCC had to go through some legal jujitsu to try to classify mobile broadband as a telecommunications service and a commercial mobile service. So it's another statutory interpretation question that will be hotly debated at oral argument, I'm sure. Now, the third issue that's been litigated has been a notice and comment issue. The petitioners have argued that the commission didn't give proper notice, that it was going to reclassify broadband under Title II after the Verizon decision in January of 2014. And the commission's response is that, no, we gave sufficient notice that not only would we adopt net neutrality rules under Section 706, but we also indicated that we were going to consider whether to rely on Title II of the Communications Act as a legal backstop. So that's an interesting issue that will also be discussed by the court, I'm sure. There's also, in terms of the fourth issue, a number of specific challenges to the net neutrality rules that the commission adopted. One of the particular rules is a internet conduct standard, and the petitioners have argued that that standard is too vague, and the commission didn't give enough notice of that particular rule, so it should be invalidated. Another particular rule that's been attacked in the litigation has been the FCC's paid prioritization rule, which prohibits ISPs from prioritizing their own traffic or content over the internet or accepting payment to prioritize an unaffiliated provider's content. Alamo Broadband and Daniel Berninger in particular have attacked that rule as exceeding the commission's statutory authority under Section 706 and the particular provisions of Title II that the commission relied on in the order. I believe I'm up to the fifth issue, is the First Amendment issue that we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail later. And the sixth issue that the CLECs are raising in the case is the forbearance issue, which again is about whether the commission complied with Section 10 of the Communications Act, which governs its forbearance authority, when it decided not to apply some of the specific provisions of Title II to internet access service providers. So I think with that kind of overview of the key issues in the case, I'll turn it over to Adam to talk about kind of an undercurrent issue that affects all the issues that the court's likely to address in this case.
Thanks, Brett. As you've heard from Brett, there's a number of technical issues in this case. Strong briefs on those issues filed by folks like Brett and his colleagues on behalf of Alamo. The briefs filed on behalf of the petitioners, the U.S. Telecom Association, all the other groups in the briefs that Scott Angstrich and the folks at Kellogg Huber and other firms wrote. There's really great briefs in this case on those issues. We got involved in this case to give the court a perspective on some of the broader issues that they've been described as constitutional issues that sort of overarch the case. When we say constitutional issues, what we really mean, to be more accurate to say, are constitutional principles that ought to inform and sort of undergird the statutory construction issues in this case. So we got involved, my firm, Boyd & Grant Associates. We filed intervener briefs for Tech Freedom, for a cloud computing company, and for a group of investors and entrepreneurs who have been deeply involved in a lot of these technologies for a long time. Jeff Pulver, who helped co-found Vonage and is one of the founding fathers of Voice over Internet. Scott Bannister, Charles Giancarlo, Wendell Brown, and David Frankel. And we filed these briefs along with Baron Soka and Tom Struble and the folks at Tech Freedom. And so it was a lot of fun to work with the experts in the field. But like I said, our issues really were a little bit broader in terms of statutory construction. We looked at three recent doctrines in which the Supreme Court, or three doctrines that the Supreme Court has really recently returned to or expounded upon, that try to inform the task of statutory construction with the constitutional principles of the separation of powers and checks and balances. So the three basic principles are the doctrine of the major questions doctrine, in which the court presumes that Congress did not delegate agencies the power to unilaterally decide the most important, economically important or politically important policy decisions. The court's presumption that Congress has to decide those issues for themselves. Second was a doctrine that came up recently in a Clean Air Act, a greenhouse gas case, Utility Air Regulatory Group. That's the principle that if an agency has to go out of its way to modify or tailor or basically rewrite a statute in order to make its regulatory program work, then that's a pretty strong signal that the agency actually doesn't have jurisdiction over the issue to begin with. And then the third principle, and I'll return to each of these, the third principle is called the significant risk doctrine. This comes out of the benzene cases that the Supreme Court decided in the 80s and then in a few subsequent D.C. Circuit cases, and then which the court reaffirmed in its non-delegation case of Whitman in the early 2000s. And this is the principle that if an agency is trying to impose heavy, costly, burdensome regulations on an industry without any real showing that these regulations are actually necessary to prevent an actual significant risk of harm to the public, that the court should not allow that to happen because it presumes then that Congress has given the agency open-ended powers to regulate even where such regulations are unnecessary. So let me go through these one at a time real briefly. The first was the major questions doctrine. This is the case, this is the doctrine most famously seen in Brown versus Williamson, the tobacco case of the late 90s, and then again in King v. Burwell, where the Supreme Court said in those cases that it won't presume that Congress has delegated to the agency authority to decide questions of major economic or political significance. The court's going to presume instead that those issues remain with Congress, not the courts, or not the agencies, absent a strong, clear, express statement from Congress that it actually is giving these powers to the agency. So in the Brown and Williamson case, it was the FDA's claim of jurisdiction over tobacco that they resisted. You know, in other cases in the D.C. Circuit, there was a case a few years ago coming out of financial regulation where the FTC tried to regulate lawyers in the practice of law, saying that lawyers fell within a statute's definition of financial institutions. And the D.C. Circuit struck that rule down, saying that this would so dramatically change the nature of regulation of lawyers that the court wouldn't presume from statutory silence that Congress had actually, or even from a statutory ambiguity, that Congress had delegated that power to the agency. In this case, our argument is that Congress did not expressly and clearly delegate power to the FCC to just unilaterally regulate the Internet in this way, and then the absence of a clear expression of delegation of power by Congress, that the FCC can't claim these powers. And in fact, we pointed to a statute, Section 230 of Title 47 of the U.S. Code from the 1996 Telecommunications Act, where Congress expressly said that it's the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the Internet and other interactive computer services unfettered by federal and state regulation. We said this is a clear statement by Congress that actually the FCC doesn't have these powers. But even in the absence of this statute, this language, we argued, what the FCC needs to point to justify its massive grab of jurisdiction power over the Internet is a plain statement of authority from Congress, and no such statement exists. And so therefore, the court should not allow the FCC to claim this power. And this argument actually worked at two levels. One is it's an argument that should inform the court's statutory interpretation. But second, it also should inform the court's decision as to whether or not to use the Chevron deference framework in interpreting the statute. This is the lesson of King v. Burwell. Before the majority of the Supreme Court in that case affirmed the Obama administration's subsidies of federal health care exchanges, the Supreme Court, in its opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, went out of its way to say that this was an issue of such such economic and political significance that they would not apply Chevron at all. They'd interpret the statute for themselves. Even if the statute was ambiguous, they would not defer because it was just too important of a question. And so in this case, in our briefs, we argue that not only does the major questions doctrine mean that the FCC shouldn't be allowed to have these powers, but second, we argue that the major questions doctrine explains why the court should not apply Chevron at all, and no matter what, should interpret the statute for itself without any deference. So that's the first of the three doctrines, major questions. The second was the tailoring rule that we draw from the Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA Clean Air Act case from a couple of years ago. That was the case where the EPA tried to impose a new permitting regime on manufacturers and power plants and others for the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. And in that case, the EPA had announced this policy, but then had, in effect, rewritten its statutory and regulatory framework, you know, setting aside all sorts of normally applicable requirements under this kind of permitting regime, tailored all of those away, because they knew that if they didn't waive all of those requirements, the regulatory program would have been just catastrophically burdensome, both on industry and on the regulators themselves. And the Supreme Court struck that down and said the fact that the agency was trying to rewrite the statute so plainly is pretty strong evidence that the agency's basic interpretation of its own authority was wrong to begin with. We see a similar dynamic at play in this case, because in addition to claiming authority over broadband internet, the FCC then went on to announce that it was undertaking what it called, or exercising forbearance, or throughout the rule it also calls it tailoring, basically waiving a significant, extensive number of ordinarily applicable regulations and rules that apply in this sort of framework when the FCC is regulating something under Title II of the Communications Act. In this case, the FCC waived all of those because it said or it acknowledged that this would be extremely burdensome otherwise on industry and might deter investment. I mean, obviously, we're glad that the FCC, in claiming power, is waiving a lot of these regulations, because we agree they would be ruinous on industry. But the thing is, we don't think the FCC recognizes the real significance of this. The FCC ought to take its need to waive all of these rules, not just as a pragmatic decision, but it ought to recognize it for what it is, namely a giant red flag that its basic policy and its basic interpretation of the scope of its power under the telecommunications laws is just fundamentally mistaken and misguided. We're glad that this case, the Utility Air Regulatory Group case, was decided just 2 years ago, because we hope it's fresh in the minds of the Supreme Court and that it will in the D.C. Circuit, and it will inform the court's interpretation of the statute here. There was a great line at the end of that case, at the end of the Utility Air Regulatory Group case, where Justice Scalia says that the court would refuse to stand on the dock and wave goodbye to the EPA as it set off on its multi-year voyage of self-discovery. We think the same is true here, that the court should not just step aside and wave goodbye to the FCC as a bare majority of FCC commissioners decide that they're going to regulate the broadband internet in a way that's never been done before and sort of make up the rules as they go, forbearing, or as we say in our brief, unforbearing, you know, within its discretion over time without any real accountability. The solution is not just to give the FCC authority to change and modify and tailor the rules as it sees fit. The answer is to restore the FCC to the real limits that were placed upon it by Congress in the first place. Now, the third principle, and then I'll give it back to Brett, is the significant risk principle. And like I said, this is from the case, the benzene cases of the 1980s, and then a couple of D.C. Circuit cases, and then re-recognized by the Supreme Court in Whitman. And this is, it's a pretty straightforward application of the non-delegation doctrine. What the Supreme Court said in the benzene cases was that Congress doesn't just grant agencies massive power to impose burdensome, heavy regulations for no good reason. And so when an agency sets about to impose a major regulatory scheme but can't show or doesn't show that there's an actual significant risk out there, risk of harm to the public, which would actually be prevented by this regulation, that without such a showing, the agency is in effect conjuring up a non-delegation problem. It's claiming open-ended powers from Congress. And so those sorts of statutory interpretations are disfavored, and rather the agency needs to show that there is a significant risk of harm that would be prevented by its regulatory scheme in order to justify the agency's assertion of power over that issue. Here, too, we think the FCC has failed to satisfy that test. It talks in very vague terms about the broadband internet industry's incentives or abilities, they say, to basically harm the operation of the internet for its own private gain, to disfavor certain customers, certain kinds of internet traffic. The FCC gestures sort of vaguely towards such concerns, but they don't actually make a concrete showing of this. They refer back to a couple of cases, one involving a small internet provider called Madison River. Another was a dispute between Comcast and BitTorrent over the way that Comcast was handling BitTorrent's traffic. But what the FCC doesn't show, and we point this out in our briefs, is that both of those cases ended without an actual finding of wrongdoing by the internet service provider. In the Madison River case, the government settled it for a small fine, and the parties in their consent decree agreed that the settlement reflected not a showing or admission of guilt or wrongdoing, but just rather the parties' mutual interest in avoiding the inconveniences of litigation. And in the Comcast BitTorrent case, not only did the parties themselves resolve the issue without the need for government sanction, but furthermore, the parties themselves in their agreement and the press release announcing their agreement stressed that these are the sorts of issues that need to be resolved within the industry and do not require and do not justify some sort of massive imposition of power by federal regulators. And so we pointed that out to the court in our briefs. We hope they listen because we think that each of these principles, the tailoring rule principle, the significant risk principle, and first and foremost, the major questions doctrine, really ought to counsel the judges, both of the D.C. Circuit and, if this case goes further, the justices of the Supreme Court. It should counsel them to be very skeptical of the FCC's sudden discovery of massive new powers to regulate the Internet. Brett, I'll turn it back to you now.
Thanks, Adam. I'd like to turn to talk about the First Amendment, another constitutional principle, but it is a specific principle being used by our clients, Alamo and Berninger, to attack the net neutrality rules themselves. And just to be clear, it's an argument only raised by our two petitioners and not by the other two petitioners to specifically strike down Title II regulation, but to specifically target the net neutrality rules themselves. And the First Amendment issue has become a very hotly contested issue in the litigation because really it's a clash of worldviews over corporate speech. And I think whichever way the court comes down on this issue, and I think it's an issue they're going to likely have to address in their opinion, it is going to be a groundbreaking decision either way because no circuit court has addressed the First Amendment as applied to broadband internet access service providers. So kind of with that overview, I want to talk a little bit about the three key issues that the court will likely be confronted with in the First Amendment analysis. The first is whether the First Amendment even applies to broadband internet access service providers. The second is if it does, what level of scrutiny should apply? And the third is do these net neutrality rules survive whatever level of scrutiny that the court decides upon? So just to take each of those in turn, you know, our argument for Alamo and Berninger on whether the First Amendment applies is this is just an extension of Supreme Court precedent governing or protecting the means of distributing communications. So you know, there's a long line of precedent at the Supreme Court holding that the means to distribute communications, like news racks, broadcast television, cable television, those means have always been protected by the First Amendment. Even if you view them as conduits for third party speech, even though they carry other people's speech or other providers' speech, they are still entitled to First Amendment protection. And the argument we make is that internet access service providers are no different than any other line of those cases where the court has extended First Amendment protection to those companies that are providing the means to distribute the communications of the day. So really two ways that ISPs can be afforded protection. The court could find they're engaged in speech under the First Amendment because they engage in editorial discretion when they decide whether to transmit certain content, or they're members of the press. There's a press clause in the First Amendment, and ISPs certainly transmit news and other information that's relevant to the public. And you know, our argument is really based on the Turner decision from the Supreme Court in 1994, which said that, yes, cable operators are entitled to First Amendment protection, even though they, when they transmit the traffic of third parties, they are just conduits for the speech of third parties. You know, cable operators have to make editorial decisions about what content to carry over their networks, and ISPs are no different. They decide and they actively manage the traffic on their networks to ensure the best possible experience for their users. And the FCC recognizes that in the order because it finds that, you know, ISPs have to engage in reasonable network management to make sure their networks run efficiently. So we, the government, are going to allow ISPs to block and not allow their customers to access certain traffic, like or let certain traffic reach them, like spam or malware, copyright infringement, child pornography, things that are illegal or harmful to the network. ISPs exercise their discretion to block that traffic. So that's just an example of ISPs do engage in the type of activities that the Supreme Court has recognized qualifies them as speakers under the First Amendment. On the other side, the FCC's argument is takes a very different perspective, as you can imagine. Their argument is that the First Amendment doesn't even apply or protect ISPs when they're providing broadband internet access service. You know, they view ISPs not as engaging in speech at all because the analogy they use is when an ISP connects their user to NewYorkTimes.com, the user wouldn't think that the ISP is engaging in any type of communicative activity at all. So that's their bottom line point, is that there's no expressive activity here. You can't view this as speech because ISPs are simply conduits. They're not communicating a message of any sort. They're just connecting a user to the content of their choice, and nobody would associate that content with the ISP. I think you just have two very different worldviews of how to approach this problem, and the court's going to have to choose one of the two worldviews. We think we have the stronger argument based on the Supreme Court's precedent and what the implications would be if you don't protect the 21st century means of transmitting content to consumers. So the second issue I think the court's going to have to grapple with, assuming they decide that the First Amendment applies here, is what level of scrutiny is going to apply. We've argued in the first instance for strict scrutiny, or in the alternative for intermediate scrutiny. And so, you know, if the court decides that strict scrutiny applies, that's typically a death knell for the government's regulation because they have to show a compelling government interest and that the rules in themselves are narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. The FCC argues for intermediate scrutiny, which was the scrutiny level applied in the Turner case. We have a couple of arguments for why strict scrutiny should apply. Typically, compelled speech cases are strict scrutiny cases, and our argument here is that what these rules require is that ISPs transmit all lawful traffic. They are compelled to carry all speech over the internet, including speech they disagree with, including, you know, things like pornography, Nazi hate speech, Islamic State videos, even if they would, if they had the discretion to do so and the rules permitted it, even though they would block that content or choose not to exercise their discretion to transmit that content. So not only is it compelled speech, we have argued that the rules discriminate against speakers on the internet. And so you can view ISPs, as I said, as a conduit, but there are other conduits for the transmission of third-party speech over the internet. Think of a company like YouTube. It allows users to upload their own content to the web and to the YouTube platform, and YouTube then decides to transmit that content to the world. And I think there's no disputing the fact that YouTube exercises discretion whether to allow certain content on its network, and they certainly decide not to allow pornography and other things that they don't feel are appropriate on their platform. And so we argue there's really no basis to distinguish between that type of internet conduit and ISPs. the FCC's response is that ISPs are very different than YouTube or Facebook, other third-party platforms. Those are, their point is, those are more content distribution, content creation companies. They're not engaged in internet access, and as the FCC has found, internet access service providers have the incentive and ability to act as gatekeepers and block access along the last mile. So in terms of deciding what scrutiny to apply, the court's going to have to grapple with, you know, how do the rules, these net neutrality rules, restrict speech in the first place? And so we've talked a little bit about, you know, the rules require ISPs to carry all traffic through the no blocking and the no throttling rules. There's also the paid prioritization rule, and that rule says, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, ISPs can't prioritize certain traffic over their network for compensation or their own content. So, you know, the way to view that rule as restricting speech is that ISPs can't engage in, can't use their networks to favor certain content that they would like to favor. So, for example, ISPs create their own content, their own news websites, their own web pages. The rules don't allow them to transmit that content faster than any other content on the web. And we argue that's an infringement of ISP's editorial discretion, in the same way that if the government were to tell cable operators that they couldn't favor certain cable programmers or channels by putting certain channels on a lower tier or a cheaper tier of cable channels, that would also restrict the freedom or editorial discretion of cable operators to decide how to present their content to or content to their customers. So once the court settles on the level of scrutiny, the court has to decide whether the rules satisfy that level of scrutiny. As I said, if it's strict scrutiny, I think that forebodes very poorly for the FCC. But if it's intermediate scrutiny, which is the level of scrutiny in the Turner case, I think there's an interesting arguments and difficult arguments on both sides. And you know, our argument is, the FCC made no effort to tailor these net neutrality rules at all because it didn't view ISPs as speakers at all, as implicating any speech activity whatsoever. And so if there's no effort to tailor the rules, then they're certainly not tailored to serving any government interest at all. But in terms of what interest these rules are designed to advance, I mean, the FCC's main argument is that these rules ensure a level playing field for all speech on the internet. And our contention is that has never been even a legitimate interest for the government to try to equalize all speech. And the Supreme Court addressed this in the Citizens United case, which was a corporate speech case. But the idea that the government should be in the business of leveling the opportunity to speak in any platform and in any medium is anathema to the First Amendment and not even a legitimate interest. The other argument we've made is that, you know, the rules are not sufficiently tailored, and they're designed to directly designed to suppress speech because they foreclose editorial discretion altogether on the part of ISPs. So the entire purpose of net neutrality is to foreclose ISPs from exercising any discretion that they may have to block or throttle content that they disagree with. If you view that as an exercise of editorial discretion, then the rules themselves are directly related to the suppression of speech, which is not a permissible goal. I think that'll wrap up my remarks on the First Amendment, Dean, and I'll turn it over to you. Or I think we're going to go back to Adam to give a few concluding remarks.
Yeah, before we do that, let me open the floor to questions and people can begin queuing up if they have a question. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me do two things. First, announce our schedule of calls for next week. We have a call every day next week, a telephone conference call. So rather than go through the whole list, I will just ask folks to look out for the Monday morning email announcing those calls, but also visit our website for the schedule of upcoming calls. Adam White, I wonder if you want to spend a minute or two talking about the broader context of this case. especially with regard to some other cases recently decided. It seems that the Supreme Court might be making invitations to revisit some fairly long held presumptions about how the court relates to administrative agencies. There's a FERC case next week as well going forward.
Well, that's right, Dean. I think it's for those of us who are interested in administrative law, not just practicing it, but just find it intellectually interesting, it's a pretty fascinating moment at the Supreme Court. We've seen the recent cases, the ones that I mentioned. As you mentioned, there's a case up there right now involving FERC. FERC's policy on what's called demand response, which is an energy efficiency program that raises some pretty significant federalism problems. In that case, I think was argued this week. The audio might come out today. And then we have in the lower courts not just this net neutrality case, but the D.C. Circuit is also going to hear a challenge to the Clean Power Plan from the EPA, which is another sprawling regulatory program which raises some pretty profound administrative law issues. And I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind or keep an eye on in these cases. One is that, as we saw in King v. Burwell and Utility Air Regulatory Group, and we hopefully will see in these new cases, the breadth and scope and burdens imposed by these regulatory programs are really forcing the justices to reconsider questions about deference, both the deference that an agency receives in interpreting its own rules and the Chevron deference framework for agencies interpreting statutes. I'm not saying that Chevron will necessarily be overturned. I mean, that would really be something. But I do think that these programs are forcing the judges to reconsider Chevron and the other doctrines, at least at the edges. Second, the interesting dynamic, and we see it, you know, just in this discussion with me talking about the sort of structural constitutional considerations and then Brett talking about the First Amendment, is that in recent years, these regulatory programs of unprecedented breadth and scope and burden are raising not just – they raise two types of questions, structural constitutional concerns about what the shape and form of government is, and also the rights issues about the relationship between government and individuals. You know, we saw this in the Affordable Care Act, where you have challenges not just under the Commerce Clause and so on, but you also see the religious liberty issues that are arising in cases like Hobby Lobby. And I think it's safe to say that as we see more and more rules like this that are unprecedented in breadth and scope and burden, we're going to see more cases involving a mix of both statutory construction and sort of the underlying constitutional structural issues, and then these rights questions, which make for fascinating cases and interesting and unprecedented debates. And by the way, there was one point I wanted to add, because we mentioned it in our own brief, and the International Center for Law and Economics and some other scholars, they also stressed this in their own real fine amicus brief. But this case, the FCC policy is often shorthanded. It's referred to as net neutrality, but it's actually about a lot more than that. It's about a claim of massive power. It's not just about the policy. But more than that, the FCC's actions really do reach beyond the thing that they say they're regulating. Right now, they are focused, they say, on broadband internet. But really, by its own terms, this is going to create FCC power from what's called the last mile, the connection from the backbone of the internet to your house, but also and all the way to what's called the edge, which is these providers that these services such as voice over internet or video over internet that act as sort of the windows by which people access web content, internet content. Right now, the FCC it tries to avoid the implications of its decision, namely that the breadth of their power could reach apps, could reach voice over internet, could reach everything, and they're focusing on broadband internet. But by the statutory reinterpretations that they've undertaken, things like reinterpreting what a public switched network is, what a telecommunication service is, this opens the door to massive FCC regulation of even those things which it currently disclaims power over, which means that if this program, these statutory reinterpretations are allowed to stand, in the future it's going to be a question about whether a bare majority of commissioners can be trusted to not take its power even further. Because in a future FCC, 4, 8, 15 years down the road, the question may be whether it now wants to expressly impose, say, a net neutrality regime on YouTube or other services or edge providers, as was discussed earlier. And we've tried to put that fact in front of the court in our briefs, and the International Center for Law and Economics did the same. But hopefully this case, when it reaches the court, won't be discussed in terms of just net neutrality, but rather in terms of the basic fundamental change in legal structure that's been undertaken in service of a net neutrality policy.
On that issue of deference and the court, I mentioned, and you've mentioned as well, the FERC case, and we do have a teleforum on Tuesday at 1 p.m. coming up. I want to mention that because Eric Jaffe is our expert, and Eric is a former Clarence Thomas clerk who's one of the justices who's sort of at the center of this idea of an invitation to revisit perhaps Chevron, at least around the edges, as you suggest. We've got one caller who's patiently waiting. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Otherwise, let's take this first call now.
Hey, Mike Doherty here, CEO of LabMD, and quite learned the hard way about the administrator of state because I'm still embroiled in the big battle with the FCC. And Adam, I really appreciated your words, but it did scramble up my question quite a bit. I wonder if you could comment about what I'm finding here in the real world. As a CEO that was ensconced in medicine, had no knowledge of administrative law, could not believe the breadth of power that they have been very motivated to really communicate this to the rest of the business community. I find myself in hot demand the past 2 months and the next and early next year now, talking to CEO groups because the amount of they used to just think, sign the consent decree, we're done, go away. Things have morphed to such a level, I think, that these people are now stunned at the amount of power that they have ceded by playing that game in the last few decades, especially when it comes to observing what the FCC has pulled and seeing what the FTC is trying to do to cybersecurity. Can you talk a little bit about your experience, maybe you too as well, Brett, with the gap with what you see in these corporate CEOs that until this date have decided just wanted to, like, you know, cut and run?
Well, this is Adam. I guess I'll answer first. I mean, I agree with you. I think that there's been quite an awakening in recent years within the business community as to what it means to make an agreement with the government and to cede governmental authority over an industry. You know, one good example of this I've returned to a lot, it actually comes from the very beginning of this administration, when the White House and Treasury and the EPA and others in the administration worked to cut a deal of sorts with the auto industry. This is at a time when two of the three big automakers were really in trouble, needed financial help. And so the administration basically cut a deal with them, namely, we'll give you financial support, we'll help you through this, and in return, you're going to sign off on the EPA and State of California's first round of greenhouse gas emission regulations. The House Oversight Committee did a great report sort of detailing this agreement, how it came about, which is pretty shocking in and of itself, and then the implications that followed from it. I think the auto companies that signed that agreement, you know, they were doing what may well have been prudent from a sort of short-term perspective in terms of getting financial help and sort of helping the industry recover. But what they found over subsequent years was that this regulatory program they'd signed on to began to unfold in ways that they really didn't expect, became much more burdensome than they ever could have dreamed, and really limited their options in ways that they didn't expect. You know, that sort of deal gives rise in the long run to a massive, an expansive suite of regulations over automobiles, over so-called stationary sources and others, and it really started with a deal between some auto companies and the White House. It under the old sort of regulatory regimes in which the agencies were much less aggressive in their statutory interpretations, much less aggressive in terms of overhauling national policy, and in a time when they are much less aggressive in imposing massive, costly regulations, sort of unbounded by Congress, you know, perhaps it made sense for individual industry or individual companies within an industry to minimize their own litigation risk, to minimize their regulatory uncertainty, and to minimize other problems with government by signing off on an agreement or a consent decree ceding government authority and then trusting that the government wouldn't abuse that authority. I think in recent years we've found that the administrative state has significantly changed in those respects, and that agreements that seem much less dangerous 10, 20, 30 years ago are much more dangerous today.
Mr. Schumann, do you have anything on this point?
Yeah, I do. I'd love to follow up. Again, this is Brett Schumann. Just to tie it back to enforcement and the net neutrality context, this order that's on appeal in the D.C. Circuit now, I think, delegates an extraordinary amount of power to the Enforcement Bureau of the FCC to fill in the gaps in the FCC's rules about how they're going to apply in specific circumstances. So the FCC has adopted bright line rules and a future internet conduct standard, and they've identified a number of factors about how to apply the rule, and they said, if you have a particular service or application that you are thinking about developing, come bring it to the FCC. We'll give you an advisory opinion through the Enforcement Bureau about whether this violates the rules or not, but hey, it's not binding. It's going to be public, so you have to disclose your confidential business plans. And basically what the FCC has said to the Enforcement Bureau is you're going to be the policymaking arm in the net neutrality context going forward. We've already adopted bright line rules and some general principles. So the Enforcement Bureau is now going to be making policy through consent decrees and enforcement actions, which I think is a very dangerous and scary proposition.
We've got a couple callers with questions pending, so let's go right to our next call. If you'd like to join that conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
It seems to me that a big distinction between most First Amendment activity and the Internet providers is generally they provide the last mile, which is regulated by the local governments. And so the local governments get monopoly power over that last mile and often try to regulate the debate by threatening the Internet provider or being more cooperative in keeping competition away from the Internet provider in the last mile. And that distinguishes it from most other First Amendment activity. I don't think that gives the FCC justification to regulate it, but I think it's a distinction with other media.
This is Brett Schumann. I mean, that's a fair point. That's one of the FCC's point is that ISPs are gatekeepers over the last mile connection between the consumer and the ISP, and so they have a level of power over their own customers that other platforms like YouTube do not. In terms of your specific question, internet access is not regulated at the local level. Cable franchises certainly are, but the local governments have a lot less authority to regulate other types of services, including internet access. So, but you certainly raise a valid point that the FCC is making that it's the last mile connection between the customer and the company that distinguishes ISPs from these other kinds of gatekeepers. And our response is that this is still a means of distributing communications, and the implications of not affording First Amendment protection to ISPs, I think, are profound, because if the FCC is in the business of telling and has basically unlimited discretion to tell ISPs that they're required to carry all lawful traffic, then they can also get into the business of telling ISPs what they can't carry. So if the First Amendment doesn't apply here, then there is no constitutional limitation on the government telling ISPs that they have to block controversial content that the government doesn't want transmitted over the airwaves.
Mr. White, anything on this point, or should we carry on?
I think we can carry on.
All right. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone.
Thanks. This is Tricia Pauletta from Harris Wilcher and Grannis, and I was going to ask the panelists about something that Brett addressed anyway in his response to the prior question or the two questions back, and that was the kind of mother may I implementation the FCC has set up. While you've been talking, there was just a press blurb from Politico that the ombudsman from the FCC has stepped aside and, you know, after 4 months. I guess it was more work than he or she anticipated, and they're going to put another person in there who's going to, you know, be working also in the Wireless Bureau while she continues the ombudsman job. Anyway, I mean, as you already mentioned, I think it's extremely chilling that in addition to overregulation without showing any evidence of risk, they have set up this kind of mother, may I, you know, central command, Soviet-style form of economic activity. I mean, that's very troubling. So do either of your briefs address the FCC's implementation of this as well, you know, on that score in terms of having to go to the FCC and share your confidential plans and get permission to take, you know, certain business models, you know, to market? Thank you.
Well, I can take the lead on this. Is Brett Shumate. I can answer first because we do raise that point in our First Amendment brief. We there's an analogy to Citizens United where in that case one of the components of the FEC's regulation of corporate speech was that you could go to the FEC and ask them for permission about whether you could give this money or that money. And the Supreme Court said that's really problematic because it has a chilling effect on speech if you have to go to the government first to inquire whether you can undertake a certain activity. And so we make that point here with the advisory opinion process in the FCC's open internet order. I mean, that is a tremendous, first of all, if you view ISPs as speakers and their decisions about what kind of content to carry as speech, if they have to go to the FCC to get permission and, you know, to avoid potential scrutiny or liability, that has a really chilling effect if you have to go to the Enforcement Bureau first, disclose your business plans, and get permission to, you know, engage in data caps or zero rating or other types of, you know, anytime you're messing with content, go to the FCC. Those types of activities are going to be really chilled, I think, under the advisory opinion process.
Yeah, this is Adam. You know, we didn't focus on this aspect of the order in that particular way, but we do focus on the fact that DPA has just characterized its own discretion in the broadest possible terms. It says at one point in the order that it has significant, not unfettered authority and discretion to settle the best regulatory or deregulatory approach to broadband. And we point out in our brief that this sort of approach where the agency can basically pick and choose which regulatory tools to flick on and flick off like a light switch on a case-by-case basis introduces immense regulatory uncertainty into the industry, and it really it avoids any bright-line rules that might limit the agency's discretion, and rather tries to force the rest of the industry to accommodate, you know, ongoing discretion by the FCC. You know, to bring it back again to the case I was talking about earlier, the Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA case, the greenhouse gas case that involved the EPA's tailoring rule, that was another example where you had the agency basically trying to impose a massive permitting regime on the entire industry, right? Rather than allowing industry and organizations to do what they intend to do, absent, you know, a specific prohibition by the regulators, it flips it on its head and basically prohibits anything absent an affirmative consent by the government. It really is the wrong, backwards way to do it. And I think that it was that, I'll put it this way, the fact that that case, the Utility Air Regulatory Group case, involved a permitting regime, I think really did exacerbate the problems that the court saw and energized the court in push back against the agency in the case. And hopefully it'll do so here.
Thank you.
We've got about 7 minutes left, time for another question. If anybody has a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're maybe waiting to see if anybody else will ring in. Let me ask just a couple quick questions. One, you know, with the CLEX arguing forbearance on the same side of the V as you gentlemen, is that an unusual alignment? If so, how did that come to pass? Is this a consolidation of cases? And does it put the FCC in just an odd situation where it's got to say, you know, we didn't regulate too much, we didn't regulate not enough, we regulated just the right amount? And then the second question I have, and you can answer either one of these, is anybody arguing that the FCC's argument essentially comes down to matters of antitrust and market dominance and market share. That, you know, in most of these towns, there are most consumers have more than one ISP to choose from, and if there's throttling or favoritism through one ISP, the consumer can go to another ISP, and all these problems, even if there's collusion between the ISPs, could be solved by the FTC, and that's the proper entity to regulate here.
Adam, do you want to take a crack first?
Well, I'll start with that last point about the role of the FCC and the FTC. That's a point in our briefs we return to repeatedly. It's that the FCC, the alternative here to the FCC's power grab is not an unregulated arena. The FTC still has the power, and as Commissioner Ajit Pai on the FCC has said, I'm sorry, I'm wading into too many acronyms now, but as Commissioner Pai of the FCC says in criticizing this new FCC order, the FCC should leave the FTC to do what it's always done and what it can do. It doesn't need this sort of new FCC regulation to solve some of the problems that are actually alleged, assuming that those problems actually do materialize. And I'll just note at the beginning of your question, Dean, you talked about the fact that there are petitioners in this case that are challenging the FCC from the other side, saying that it didn't regulate enough. That's not particularly uncommon in and of itself. Oftentimes, you'll see an agency promulgate an order and then go into court defending that order in both directions, both against the folks who want less regulation and against the folks who want more regulation. It's not uncommon. Sometimes that actually sets the agency up as looking like it's achieved some sort of sensible compromise or middle ground. But I think it's important to note that in this case, especially just on the basic questions of the claim of FCC authority, there really isn't a fundamental disagreement between the FCC and the petitioners on the other side of the case about whether or not the FCC has gone too far. The FCC has claimed massive power. The disagreement, as I understand it, between the FCC and the petitioners on the other side is just the extent to which the FCC is going to use that power immediately. So I think on the overarching question of FCC authority and the powers that it's claiming, there really is just one argument in the case. It's between those of us challenging the FCC's claim of authority on one side of the argument and the FCC and its supporters justifying the FCC's power grab on the other side.
Yeah, this is Brett. To follow up on the second question about antitrust and market dominance, that was addressed in the order, and it is relevant to the appeal. And what the FCC said in the order was that we're not finding that ISPs have market dominance or that there's any type of market power, but we do recognize that ISPs have what they call gatekeeper control over the end user, because of the last mile connection between those two. And so they purport to adopt the rules in part because of the difficulty of switching between ISPs. Even though there may be multiple ISPs in your geographical area, it's oftentimes difficult, the commission says, to switch between those two providers because of switching costs and other things. And so the argument that we make in our First Amendment brief is that Supreme Court upheld the must-carry rules in the second Turner decision, in part because Congress had actually found that cable operators have market dominance as compared to broadcasters. And then that aspect is missing here, and that government interest that upheld the must-carry rules in Turner is missing with respect to net neutrality.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes left. Let me give each of you a chance to wrap up or express a final thought if you've got one. Let's start with Mr. White.
Well, I appreciate everybody dialing in and listening to this, asking good questions. Like I said, I think this case is important in and of itself, but I also think it's important in the way that it fits into this broader trend of litigation involving the structure and size and scope of the administrative state. No, we've had an opportunity to file two briefs in this case since we were interveners, an opening brief and a reply brief. And we filed our opening brief and discovered when the government responded that the government didn't engage these issues at all. We thought that was a surprise. We hoped that the government's silence on these structural constitutional issues is not reflected in oral argument, and we hope that the court engages these issues even where the government didn't, because we think they're very important.
Mr. Shoemate.
where the FCC didn't engage your argument, Adam, they certainly engaged in the First Amendment and really, I think, blew that issue into one of the most important issues that's likely to be decided in the case. There was actually a recent Washington Post article that talked about this case being the most, could be the most important First Amendment corporate speech case since Citizens United. And I think that's likely true because the court's going to likely opine on whether ISPs are speakers and protected by the First Amendment. And I think that's going to be a very significant constitutional ruling no matter which way the court decides.
Oral argument in this case scheduled for December 4th in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. I hope we can have both of you gentlemen back, letting us know what transpired at oral argument, how things went. But for now, I appreciate you being here today. This has certainly been an interesting discussion. To our audience, just a mention, thank you for dialing in as well and for your questions. Our next scheduled telephone conference call is Monday. We'll be talking about insider trading, a case that was dismissed by the Second Circuit and cert denied by the Supreme Court, one of the most notable cert denials in recent memory. That's our telephone on Monday. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.